Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Abraham Verghese. He burst on the scene in 1994 with a memoir called My Own Country, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. In 1999, he published his second memoir, The Tennis Partner, which was a New York Times bestseller. Cutting for Stone, which was published in 2009, is an epic autobiographical novel tracing brothers growing up in a fractured Ethiopia in the shadow of their absent father. Verghese is also a nationally respected doctor. As a professor at the Stanford School of Medicine, Verghese earned a reputation for focusing on healing in an era when technology often overwhelms the human side of medicine. Abraham Verghese, this time on the Archive Project, here in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures 2011-2012 season.
What a pleasure to be in Portland. Thank you so much for packing this place, braving the inclement weather and coming out. I'm so proud of you. I've had a wonderful day. I want to thank Andrew for that beautiful introduction and also for the opportunity to go to Jefferson High School to visit with some other writers and to be here tonight. What a treat. Thank you so much. I also learned that my book was given to all the entering freshmen at OHSU who had read the book over the summer before they joined, and I'm really, really touched by that. I think the most important thing I do is teach medical students, and I always think that if I impact on one medical student in a significant way, the number of people that they will see in a lifetime will more than justify my life, my investment. So very pleased to hear that they are here. Is that true? Are you here, 120 medical students? Somewhere? Okay. Well, I'll take your word for it. What I'd like to do tonight, with your permission, is I'd like to talk a little bit about how I came to be a physician. It's very connected to books. And I'd like to talk a bit about how being a physician brought me to write a book. So as you see, the two parts of my life that Andrew mentioned bleed into each other very much. And I'm hoping that at the end of my remarks, we can have a very lively discussion, a to and fro, about both writing and medicine, whatever's on your mind. Does that sound like a good plan to you? Good, thank you. I thought I would begin with a quote that fascinated me when I was a medical student. When I was a medical student, I was taught that Freud said that geography is destiny. And I was taught that Freud said that in the context of the proximity of the anal canal and the birth canal to all the other interesting organs nearby. And I remember thinking that that was profound. That was precisely why I had come to medical school, for those kinds of insights. And imagine my disappointment some years later to find out that Freud never actually said that. Or if he said that, he was paraphrasing Napoleon, who said, "Geography is destiny," speaking about France's position in the globe. But ladies and gentlemen, that phrase, "geography is destiny," is enormously important to me because in many ways, I think it has shaped my life, certainly shaped my parents' life. My parents come from the south of India, from a community that's predominantly Christian in Kerala, in the state of Kerala. And we believe our Christianity came from St. Thomas the Apostle coming in 52 AD and converting Brahmins to Christianity. And the reason I mention this is because when Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia made a state visit to India after his country had been liberated from Italy, he was taken to see all the usual attractions you take heads of state to see, the Taj Mahal and so on. But he said that he also wanted to see the churches of St. Thomas because he was also from an ancient Christian kingdom and he had heard about this belief and this legend. And so he arrived in Kerala where my parents were and happened to be going in his motorcade down the streets just at the moment when thousands of schoolchildren were heading off to school, their hair freshly washed and white blouses and blue skirts and blue trousers for the boys. And he was so taken by the sight of the orderliness of all these kids going to school that he hired all 400 of his teachers from this one state. And my mother and father, who were physics graduates, were hired. They arrived in Addis Ababa 2 weeks apart, had never met each other, but they eventually met and married, and my brothers and I always thought it had something to do with physics or perhaps chemistry, who knows? They're quite reticent to talk about it, I don't know why. And because they left their geography, their destiny changed completely. And because I was born in Ethiopia and not in India, my destiny was completely different from theirs. I grew up speaking the Ethiopian language very fluently. I can still, if I'm not careful, scare the hell out of a cab driver anywhere across this country. And I have to time my introductions to when we're at a traffic stop or somewhere. I have made many, many great friendships that way. I must confess to you that I came to medicine because of a book. And I remember how that call to medicine came. It was preceded by a false call. You see, middle-class Indian parents are very much like middle-class Jewish parents, I sometimes think, in that as a child you get the impression that your choices in life are that you can be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, or a failure. These are your options. And my older brother, I have an older brother who had a precocious intellect. He had a great aptitude for mathematics. And he's gone on to be a professor at MIT for the last 20-something years. And when my brother was about 9 or 10 and announced, while he was still in short pants, when he announced that he was going to be an engineer, my parents' joy was something to behold. I mean, nothing I had ever said produced that kind of a reaction from them. And I remember feeling very put out, very much as though I had just missed something. And so I promptly announced that I was going to be a physician. Their reaction was exactly like yours. Silence. I mean, I guess I should be fortunate that they didn't dismiss it out of hand. It seemed plausible enough because I had a great deal of interest in blood, mostly my own. I was always getting into scrapes. I had a great fascination with animals being prepared for the kitchen next door, animals giving birth, animals engaged in that strange congress that I didn't realize was related to birth. But now all that could pass as a form of scholarship because I was going into medicine. And nothing more was said about that, which is why when my real call to medicine came sometime later, it took me by surprise. And it came because of a book. It came because of a book. I was always a precocious reader. I had no great aptitude for anything in the school curriculum, but I loved to read. And I read with a purpose. I remember discovering Lady Chatterley's Lover when I was 9. And I found Lolita when I was 10. And I picked up the book that was to change my life because the title, Of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham, the title held great promise. But it turned out the book was so much better than anything I could have imagined. For those of you who remember the book, and for those of you who don't, it begins in the most unusual way. You're introduced on page 1 to a young boy, Philip, and he's being brought in on page 1 to say goodbye to his mother who's dying. She's on her deathbed. The father's not in the picture. The father's gone. And on page 2, you realize that he has a club foot. He has a deformity of his foot. And by page 3, the mother is dead. I can't think of a more dismal start to any novel. And yet something about the magic of Maugham's writing, very, very plain writing, you keep reading. And Philip is brought up by foster parents who are very strict, a pastor and his wife. And he's bullied in school. It's a very unhappy childhood. And his only outlet is that he loves to paint. He's a painter. He has some aptitude for drawing. And so he holds on to this dream of being an artist. That's how he's going to make sense of the world and escape the unhappiness of his childhood. And as soon as he has an opportunity, when he turns 18, he escapes to Paris to become an artist. And he's thrilled. He's taking lessons with Monsieur Fournier, a famous teacher and artist who exhibits at the National Gallery. He's living in the Left Bank. He's associating with other artists. And as the months go on, though, he's having some doubts about his situation because his money's running out and he's beginning to wonder whether he has the talent to do this, to become a great artist. And one day he happens to be standing outside his garret, freezing in the street. And he's standing there because he's avoiding the landlady who's looking for the rent. And he's freezing because he sold his coat. And he's hungry. And he sees his teacher come walking by. And on an impulse, he stops his teacher and he says, "Would you please come up to my garret and look at my paintings and tell me if I have what it takes to go on, because I'm really at my wit's end." And the teacher, against his better judgment, decides to go up and take a look at all the paintings, and he spends a long time looking at them, and then he asks him how his resources are, and Philip is very apologetic about that and says that he doesn't have very much more money. And at that point, Monsieur Fionnier says an interesting thing, which I've never forgotten. He says, "Don't be apologetic about not having money. For an artist, money is like a sixth sense, and without it, the other five don't work very well." Which I always thought was profound advice. I mean, when I'm asked to give writing advice, which is not very often, and I'm not being facetious, I will always say, get a good day job. Preferably get something you love, that you're passionate about. Because I think it's so hard to pay the bills and send your kids through college banking on the next book. And I've always felt very, very blessed to have the first career, the only career that I very, very much love. But to come back to our story, Monsieur Fournier then looks at all the paintings and then finally turns to Philip and says, essentially, "Is there something else you could be doing?" which must have crushed Philip, who had held on to this dream for so long. And yet, it was what he wanted to hear. It's why he brought Monsieur Fournier up, to get the truth. And Monsieur Fournier, seeing his distress, hurries on to say to him, "Don't take this badly. I wish someone had told me what I'm telling you now when I was your age. There is nothing worse for the temper than to discover one's own mediocrity at an advanced age." That's the exact line. And so Philip, you know, with his tail between his legs, decamps for London, where there's a small annuity left for him to pursue a professional education. And because of his club foot and all he's been through, he decides to go to medicine. And the first 2 years are sheer drudgery, hard work. But then finally, he arrives at that moment when, as medical students do today, in their third year, where they finally step onto the wards and see patients. And Somerset Maugham describes the moment in this fashion. "Philip saw humanity there in the rough, the artist's canvas, and he said to himself, 'This is something I can do. This is something I can perhaps be good at.'" Philip saw humanity there in the rough, the artist's canvas, and he said to himself, "This is something I can do. This is something I can perhaps be good at." Ladies and gentlemen, those lines spoke to me. It was as though they had been written for me. They implied that not everybody, or not anybody, could just be a gifted mathematician, a gifted artist, a gifted writer, but anybody with a basic curiosity and interest in the human condition, anybody with a basic empathy for their fellow human being could be a good physician. That's what I took away. I had found my calling. I mean, the moment was so profound that it was almost like, you know, St. Paul hearing voices on the road to Damascus. It was an epiphany. And yet I couldn't say to my parents, "I'm decided to go into medicine," because they thought I already had. And I was also discovering the beautiful thing about books, and that is that these quiet inner moments of awakening are far, far more profound than the outward declarations of intent. And that was the moment I decided to become a physician. And I almost hesitate to mention this book because it's not the sort of book that you can guarantee will have this effect on every medical student. It had that effect on me. And I think that's what books do. They speak to us very, very individually. In fact, if I were to recommend books to put in the hands of medical students, I would recommend The Citadel by A.J. Cronin. Very well read in Britain, less so here. I would recommend Arrowsmith by Sinclair Lewis. I would recommend Not as a Stranger by Frank Slaughter. A host of books. But, you know, you never know which book is going to do that for a young reader. And as Andrew said, of all the plaudits for the book, the ones that I cherish the most are the letters that say the book made them see medicine as an adventurous and romantic pursuit, much in the way that I saw it. I was fortunate to enter medical school in Ethiopia in a school started by the British Council for East Africa. And we had wonderful professors, many of them British, who had just retired in Britain and been pressed into one more year of service in East Africa before they finally retired. And these were the most colorful, wonderful teachers, full of stories, and many of the things that they said found their way into Cutting for Stone. They were really quite extraordinary. I remember the anatomy professor, we happened to be in a six-story building, and the anatomy professor asked one of my fellow students, a woman, he asked her, which has more muscle, the bladder or the uterus? And she thought this was a trick question, so she said, the bladder? To which he said, young lady, if the bladder had as much muscle as the uterus, you could pee right over this building. That, by the way, did not find itself into the book. I just couldn't find a six-story building to pee over, actually, and otherwise it would have. My education in Ethiopia was wonderful, but in my third year of medical school, just as I was on the wards, that moment that Philip described, just as I was saturating with 3 months of medicine, surgery, obstetrics, enjoying it tremendously, the emperor was deposed. Civil war broke out. Many of my classmates became guerrilla fighters fighting against the harsh military government that took over. In fact, ironically, one of my classmates fought for 23 years against this government and finally was in the vanguard of troops that marched back into the capital and unseated Mengistu, who was like the Stalin of Africa. And he's now the prime minister of the country that my classmate is. But at the time, what the military government did was to close the school for a year, send all the students to the countryside to educate the masses, because the military was very worried about having the intelligentsia, the students in the city. And so they just sent them all out to educate the masses. And expatriates were told they could leave. And I had never heard the word expatriate before, nor did I understand that it applied to me. It was a real moment of dislocation. It really, in a way, is sort of the moment for me of uprootedness, if you will. And so I came to America to join my parents, who had left the year before, seeing the writing on the wall. And ironically, I felt that their leaving was disloyal. I had been angry with them for leaving. But it turned out they had been wise. And I joined them in New Jersey, where they were teaching school. And I had a problem. I had 3 years of medical school, but in most parts of the world, you go straight from high school to pre-medicine to med school. There is no degree that you take beforehand. And so I had no college degree, and here I was trying to apply to transfer to medical school. It was almost impossible. And so I began to work in a succession of nursing homes and in a hospital in Raritan Valley, New Jersey, as an orderly. And I look back now on the year and a half that I spent working as a nursing assistant, as an orderly. I look back on it as the most profound medical education I ever had, because I really got to see what happens to the patient in the 23 hours and 57 minutes that the doctors are not in the room. It also left me with most profound respect for my colleagues in nursing and the ancillary fields, because they're the ones who really are caring for the patient. I eventually was able to finish my medical schooling in India. Irony there, the Indian government took me in as a displaced person, a land that I didn't really know that well, and I finished medicine there. And I came to the United States and trained in internal medicine and then in infectious disease. And I want to tell you about the moment that I became a writer. It happened in the late 90s. In the mid-90s, I was training in Boston and in infectious diseases just as HIV was arriving. And I remember the excitement and the fear as we saw young men coming in with bizarre infections, things like pneumocystis pneumonia and Mycobacterium avium infection, all of which we had seen before, but always in the context of cancer or transplant and so on. But these young men had no such explanation. I remember the fear and the excitement of that year. And then the announcement that the virus had been found by Gallo and Montagné, or Montagné and Gallo, depending on who you believe. And then the sense of you know, well, it's all over now. I guess we'll now have a cure and everything be okay. Instead of which, as soon as the virus was discovered, a blood test was also invented to test for the virus, and it became apparent that for every one patient we were seeing in the hospital, there were perhaps 200 to 300 others out there carrying the virus, and everything we knew suggested that they would too also have the same inexorable downhill decline that the patients in the hospital had. But I was leaving Boston. I was going to Johnson City, Tennessee, population 50,000, to a new medical school there. And all the experts, all the pundits said that I could expect to see one HIV-infected patient every other year. That was the prediction for a town that size. AIDS was an urban disease. And certainly when I got there, at first I didn't see any AIDS, but then I saw my first patient in a few months. And then in a few months I saw another patient. It became a monthly event, then it became a weekly event, then it became a twice a week event. And in a short time, I had accumulated 100 patients with HIV infection in a town of 50,000, when I should have seen one. And, you know, it was a great sort of mystery of why this town should have so much. Actually, it wasn't that big of a mystery after all. I remember sort of recognizing fairly early on that I was stumbling onto a paradigm. It was not that the town was a hotbed of sexual intrigue and duplicity, which it was, by the way, but that wasn't the explanation. Instead, it appeared that I had stumbled onto a paradigm of migration, and it's a paradigm that goes like this. Young man grows up in a small town and leaves for all the same reasons that you and I leave small towns. Jobs, education, opportunity. But in their case, they were also leaving because they were gay and did not want to live that lifestyle under the close scrutiny of their friends and relatives. So they left as part of the general exodus, and they went to the big city and found themselves. And sometimes decades later, the virus found them, and they were now coming back to their hometowns, either because they were sick or because they hoped by retreating to a simpler rural existence they would beat this virus that had killed all their friends. And there I was at the tail end of this migration, seeing more patients than anyone expected. And I remember the moment when I saw this paradigm so clearly. I had a patient who was called Hobart in the book that I wrote about that subsequently. And Hobart exemplified the paradigm. He was the son of a preacher. He had an older brother. And he remembers walking through the schoolyard when he was 7 and his brother was 9. And his brother turning to him and saying, "Must you walk in that manner? Must you walk that way?" And he was not aware that the way he walked was in some fashion different from the rest of the world. And as he grew older, he became aware of more and more differences that were pointed out to him, so that by the time he was 18, he felt as if he were an alien in that town, even though he looked the part. And so he escaped. He made his brave escape. He joined the Navy, and when he was finally retired out of the Navy, he went to San Francisco, perhaps the one city in the country where the way he talked, the way he walked, his taste in art, his taste in music, were not about to attract any attention, and his sexuality was accepted. He had a wonderful life there, lived there for 2 decades, worked in a 5-star hotel, wore a tuxedo every day, and one morning he woke up with severe chest pain, was admitted to San Francisco General, ironically taken care of by a friend of mine. Now, this is one of the life's great ironies, how we all connect. And they considered all the usual suspects, heart attack, pleurisy, but none of that panned out until the third day when he broke out with a rash that looked like dewdrops on rose petals and turned out to be shingles, and also found to be HIV positive. And the shingles was complicated by inflammation of the brain, inflammation of the lining of the spinal cord. And to make a long story short, he was in the hospital for 2 months. And when he finally came out, barely alive, his job was gone. He'd been evicted from his apartment. All his belongings were in the basement of a friend's apartment, a friend who was also sick and in the hospital. And so he made the one phone call he must have dreaded to make to his parents to say, "I have AIDS and I'm coming home." And that's how I first met him. And over the next few months, I got to know him pretty well, but there came this, you know, there were no medications in that era to do the magic we now do routinely. And all you could do was preside over these patients' decline. And I got to know him very well, and I remember a few weeks before he died, he had a high fever. I put him in the hospital. I tried to find out what the cause of the fever was. And on the third day of hospitalization, when I still couldn't elucidate the cause, and I thought it was the virus, basically unchecked, causing fever. He said to me, "Abraham, I don't want anything more done. I want you to let me go home." And I couldn't argue with him. We both knew he was going to die. And when he went home, a few days later, he called me, turned out to be 2 days before he died. And he said, "Abraham, when I die, I don't want an autopsy. But if you like, you can come to my house and take biopsies of some of my organs. And that way you'll know why my spleen was so enlarged. And you'll know, you know, why my liver was riddled with this." And I promised him that I would do that. I think he knew that I had been doing that a fair amount, because I could not find a pathologist willing to do an autopsy for fear of contracting it. Yeah, medical students here cannot imagine the kind of hysteria and paranoia of that era. And so I got the call that he had died a few days later. I went to his house. I remember taking the biopsy needles with me. And I remember walking in, and his parents were sitting on the couch, and I walked past them and walked into his bedroom. And I remember being deeply affected by the sight of his body. I mean, to this day, the sight of a body outside the hospital is dislocating for me. But his body was profoundly dislocating, because he looked so Christ-like. He was wasted and withered. His diaper looked like a loincloth. His hair had grown long and wispy. It was an image that was hard to shake. But even more than his body, I remember looking up at the walls of his room and suddenly realizing this was his childhood room. This was where he grew up. And there was a picture of Christ at Gethsemane and a needlepoint verse framed in cedar. And yet, these were not his icons. His icons were in a box in a friend's basement in San Francisco, a friend who was probably dead by now. And all of a sudden, sitting there, I could sort of see how this child had grown up in that room, full of love, loving parents, and yet, because of his sexuality, feeling as the years went by, as though he were an alien in that town. And he made his brave escape. He went to the big city and unfortunately contracted HIV. And now, here he was dying, dead, in the same room that had trapped him as a child. And it must have been the most crushing defeat to come back there, even though his parents took such great care of him. And that night I went home and I drafted a scientific paper describing this phenomenon of migration, which I was sure was playing out all over small town America. And even as I wrote the paper, which has become something of a classic, even as I wrote the scientific paper, I felt that the cold language of science didn't begin to capture the tragic nature of this voyage, didn't begin to capture the heartache of the families, didn't begin to capture my own grief at witnessing this again and again. And ladies and gentlemen, that is the moment that I decided to try to write the story of what I had just lived through. That's the moment that I made the attempt to become a writer, to put in words what I was seeing in my practice.
You're listening to a talk by Abraham Verghese. He spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2012. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
I want to move on to talking a little bit about medicine and how that's sort of informed not just my writing, but my practice of medicine. I love medicine very much. I love, being able to see patients, being able to be with them at very crucial moments in their lives. But I worry about the advent of technology. It almost seems as though, and by the way, I'm not a Luddite, I love technology. I'm in one of the cutting edge medical centers in the world. We have the most marvelous technology. I worry, though, that with technology, we've lost some of our skills and abilities to examine patients in very simple ways at the bedside and make easy diagnoses and order simple tests instead of using the test as a way to screen to see whether we should do anything or not. And I've always felt that way, but a couple of things have happened, a couple of anecdotes I want to share with you that really have changed my view on how important the exam is. The first has to do with a friend of mine who had breast cancer in Texas before I moved to Stanford. And she had her lumpectomy with us, actually with a private oncologist, and then went to great pains to interview a lot of us to determine which was the best cancer center in the world for her particular breast cancer. And she did a lot of research, had a spreadsheet, and finally picked the place and went there and had the resources to be able to do this. And I remember being surprised a few months later to realize she had come back and was getting her care with her local oncologist. And she was a friend, so I pressed her as to what had happened. And she was very reluctant to tell me. She said the cancer center was marvelous. They were, you know, really well organized. All her appointments with different people on the same day. Valet parking, concierge, you know, a 7-story atrium and a piano that played itself and all those good things. But, she said, they did not examine my breasts very well. Now, you might argue they didn't need to examine her breasts well. They knew her breast cancer at the molecular level. The sensitivity of the human hand to detect a lump in the breast compared to all the tests that they'd put her through doesn't even begin to compare. And yet, to her, it mattered. To her, it mattered enough that she had changed where she was getting her care. She was getting her care with her local oncologist, who every single time she went to see this person would do a thorough breast exam, including the axillary tail, would make her shrug and dig fingers into the fossa above the clavicle looking for supraclavicular nodes. And something about that spoke to her of a kind of attentiveness that she wanted. And I, listening to this, was really affected. It made me realize how profoundly important this was, completely out of keeping with the science and logic behind it. The other anecdote that also has shaped me had to do with, again, my experience in Texas, where I developed a reputation as being interested in patients with chronic fatigue. This is not a reputation you would wish on your worst enemy. And these patients are difficult. They've been rejected by the medical establishment often, by their families who disbelieve them. Society, we think of them as a bit of a joke, witness the laughter when I said that. And so they come to you fully prepared for you to join the long line of physicians who disappointed them. And I realized with my first or second patient that I could not do justice to this complicated story and all the tests they were bringing for me to see. I could not do justice to all that in 45 minutes. Listen to them, examine them, have recommendations in 45 minutes. It's impossible. You're guaranteeing that you'll disappoint them. And so I hit on this method where I would allow them the entire first visit to tell me their story, uninterrupted. 45 minutes. I'd bill it as a new patient visit. We know that the average American physician, we're told, interrupts their patient in 14 seconds. And if I ever get to heaven, it will be because I held my peace for 45 minutes and I let the story unfold. And I scheduled the physical exam for 2 weeks into the future. And when that time came, I was able to do a very thorough exam. I like to think I do a thorough exam anyway, but given that I had all the time now for the exam, as we'd agreed on with the patient, I could do a very thorough exam. I remember my first or second patient in this series, a very voluble patient, insisted on telling me more history in the second visit, even though we had said history is the first visit, physical is the second visit. And I began to examine the patient, and I always begin with the hand, and then I slide my fingers to the pulse while I'm looking to see if there's clubbing and redness of the palm and this and that. And then I slide my fingers to the epitrochlear lymph nodes, and then I'm into my ritual. This is my routine. And as I began my ritual, this very voluble patient began to quiet down. And I remember having an eerie sense that the patient and I had slipped back into a primitive ritual in which I had a role and the patient had a role. And when I was done, and I was actually scared to even utter a word because it seemed like I would crack some crystalline, fragile structure that had just developed around us. And when I was finally done, the patient said to me with some awe, "I have never been examined like this before." Which, ladies and gentlemen, if that were true, is a real condemnation of our healthcare system, because all I did was a head-to-toe physical exam we teach all our medical students. Then when the patient dressed, I told the patient what they had almost certainly heard in Scott and White or Mayo or wherever they had been, which is, this is not in your head, this is real. The good news, it's not cancer, it's not histoplasma, coccidiomycosis. The bad news is we don't know exactly what causes this, but here's what we should do. And I laid out the same recommendations that they'd probably heard elsewhere. And I always thought that if my patient gave up the quest for the magic doctor, the magic test, the magic bullet, and instead began to partner with me on a course towards wellness, if at all possible, it was because I had earned the right to tell them these things by virtue of the exam. Something important had transacted there. And when I moved to Stanford, I visited my colleagues in anthropology and told them the story of the chronic fatigue and the examination and how it seemed to produce something that just words could never produce. And my colleagues in anthropology immediately said, well, Abraham, you're describing a ritual. That's a ritual that you just performed. Rituals are all about transformation. You know, we engage in rituals to signify the crossing of a threshold. You know, we have rituals for baptism and bar mitzvahs, and we have rituals for, take marriage. We marry with great pomp and ceremony and expense to signal our departure from a life of misery and solitude to one of eternal bliss. I don't know why you're laughing. That was the intention, was it not? Well, I would submit to you that the act of one individual coming to another and telling them things that they would not tell their wife or husband or rabbi or preacher signifies an important ritual. And then, incredibly, they disrobe and allow touch, which in any other context would be assault. I would submit to you that this is an exceedingly important ritual, one that is worthy of our best efforts. I'm impressed by the fact that in Silicon Valley, where all kinds of cultures are there, you know, from Hmongs to Tongans to Ethiopians, Eritreans, any culture you want to name is there. Everybody has different beliefs about disease and medicine and so on. But every culture believes that if you put someone in an exam room and make him put on a paper gown, you intend to do something more substantial than stick your stethoscope on top of the gown or prod in a half-assed way in the belly and walk out. Something is expected. You've set them up for a ritual. And one of the great joys of being at Stanford is that I've been able to push on this aspect further and further. And we've gotten very interested in bedside diagnosis, not just for the ease and simplicity, but because of the ritual. So we are, and again, I'm not against technology. I think that the pocket ultrasound will almost replace the stethoscope. The more technology we can bring to the bedside and allow us to judiciously, in partnership with the patient, talk about what comes next, the better off we are, I think, in our society and in healthcare. This is partly why I think medicine is so expensive, because we're so busy ordering tests. My colleague Alan Garber, actually he's no longer my colleague, he's now provost at Harvard, but Alan Garber is a medical economist. He was an internist with us at Stanford, and he wrote this editorial where he talked about healthcare in America being the menu without prices. You know, it's like having filet mignon every night. I mean, I make rounds with my residents and my interns, and we never stop to say, well, if we get this test, what will it cost? Somebody's paying. And ladies and gentlemen, the somebody is us, and the bill is arriving shortly, and I think we're all going to be held accountable, and we will need these simple skills of being able to examine the patient, listen well, take a good history, and judiciously order tests and not subject them to radiation they didn't need, expense they didn't need, and misadventures, surgical or otherwise, that they certainly did not need. I want us to have plenty of time for questions. I always find that to be the most engaging part of the evening. So I want to leave you with a poem by a man I greatly admire. I'm a great fan of William Carlos Williams. I'm actually, this spring semester, I'm actually having the opportunity to teach undergraduates at the creative writing department. I see Phil here, Phil Knight, and I know Phil is a great friend to OHSU and to Portland, but he's our friend too at Stanford. We make claims on him. And I had a chance to share this poem with my students and tell them how much more it meant to me at my present age than when I first heard it in my 20s, because it's a very simple poem. You all know it. It was in your college anthology. It's by William Carlos Williams. And William Carlos Williams is one of my favorite people. Because he was a poet and then he became a physician. He felt that for a poet to have something to say, he felt he had to be swimming in the river of life. You couldn't be standing on the side. You had to be in it. And he was in it. He practiced in Paterson, New Jersey. In his 75th year, he wrote to a friend that he was giving up his evening clinic. And in the midst of it all, he wrote. And he wrote some timeless stuff that has survived. And here's one of his poems that has survived so well. It's a very simple poem. It goes like this. So much depends on a little red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater besides the white chicken. That's it. So much depends on a little red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chicken. And, you know, the poem can mean so many things and it will mean different things to all of us. But let me tell you that, to me, the line "so much depends on" is the line that has continued to grow and amplify for me. It's a line that says to me that, you know, for all our scientific discovery and invention, so much depends on many more things than science. So much depends on our human-to-human interaction. So much depends on the history of your life and how you bring that to this challenge you're facing. So much depends on. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Do you think we could have the lights up a little bit so now I get a chance to see them?
Anything, yes. Can we have the lights up a little bit? So this question came up a couple of times and I have to ask it now. You've talked about efficiency. I mean, you're the head of the Stanford Medical School. How do you possibly write these books and find time to have these two careers in your life? It seems almost impossible.
Well, I mean, the answer is slowly. it took me 8 years to write the last book. Joyce Carol Oates has probably written two books since breakfast this morning. You know? But again, I mean, I would resist the notion, Andrew, that I have two careers. I really feel I have one career. I'm a physician first and foremost. I feel deeply privileged to be able to stand here and say that. And everything stems from that. The writing is coming out of that. So, then there's some busy periods when I'm attending on the wards in Stanford where nothing else really happens. And then there are other times when I have more opportunities. Stanford's been incredibly sort of wise in that in hiring me, they gave me protected time to write. They actually treated my writing as though it was the equivalent of another person's research. So other professors go to their lab to do research. I go off to a second office to write, and I do that about 2 days a week on good weeks. And I can tell you where the office is, but if I show it to you, I'll have to kill you. although having said that, Phil survived, so I guess it's not it's an empty threat. So. But I always think that it's just an amazing irony in my life that when I was leaving the Iowa Writers' Workshop and looking to get back into academic medicine because I'd taken this somewhat dangerous break to go write, I had cashed in my tenure and my retirement plan to take off to Iowa, and I was looking to get back into academic medicine when my course was over, and I was interviewing all over the place and, you know, being offered positions at fairly good places, but recognizing that I would never write in those places. I'd be so busy trying to write grants and publish that I would never write the kind of book I had in mind. So I chose to go to El Paso, Texas, to Texas Tech University, the furthest outpost of American medicine. Anything further and you'd be in Mexico. And I worked in this county hospital. I loved it. I felt I learned so much medicine there. And all they wanted from me at Texas Tech in that hospital was to teach medical students, see patients, and I loved doing both those things. And my evenings and nights and weekends were my own. And I produced two books and the better part of Cutting for Stone by being there. And I always think the great irony is, had I gone to Stanford in the first place, just about now I'd be losing my tenure and heading to El Paso, Texas to take a job. You know? I tell my medical students this, that You never know. You have to follow your passion. And because I went to Texas Tech and El Paso, because I wrote, here I am at Stanford. So it's a long-winded answer to your question, but the answer is slowly. And I guess the other thing I should say is I'm not in any hurry. I'm really, you know, this is going to sound strange, but it's not that I don't want great things to happen for every one of my books, but it didn't have to happen tomorrow. I could wait to get it right. And if it never happened, I'd be all right too, because I love so much what I do. And that, I think, is the great gift of having a vocation that you love. Then the writing becomes not secondary, because it's terribly important to me, but you know, your ego and your life isn't riding on it. You're just writing because you love to write and you have something to say. And yeah, you hope good things happen with it. And hey, I packed the house, so good things have happened, you know?
Well, yeah.
Thank you.
We have really just time for one more question, and I think, you know, you're in a room full of fans, and we talked a little bit, I normally don't ask this question, but we talked a little bit about this backstage, so I feel it's sort of fair game, maybe, or I hope. I mean, I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about what you're doing now in terms of your writing and what we should be expecting to see someday from the next project.
Yeah. You know, it's a question I kind of dread because, you know, when you're out with your book and speaking, almost the second question anybody asks you after what does the title Cutting for Stone mean, the second question is, what are you working on now? And, you know, my instinct is to say, what the hell's wrong with what I just gave you? And I was at a reading somewhere, I can't quite remember where, and this little old lady came up to me and asked me this question, what are you working on now? And I gave some sort of evasive answer, which I'm not about to give you. I'll give you a more firm answer. And she put her finger in my face and she said, you owe it to your readership to produce another book. And I was so grateful to her. I mean, I think I walked away thinking, wow, yes, you know, lots of people have done me the honor of reading this book and buying it, preferably not borrowing it. And I have a readership of sorts, and I have an obligation. So that was the moment that I really began to, you know, feel the sense of I must write another book. And I actually just came back from visiting Kerala, India, where my parents are from. It's a land that I know fairly well from summer vacations and from going back years later in medical school. And I'm hoping to set a novel there because I think one of the things that made Cutting for Stone interesting was geography emerging as a character. You know, the character of Ethiopia, in a sense, imbued the book. And I wanted to find something exotic and yet unfamiliar to most Western readers. And so I'm setting the book there. I don't quite know what the whole book is going to be about. And I'm the sort of writer who begins by following a voice and an image and pushing it forward. And which, by the way, many people would argue is not the way to do it. And my friend John Irving knows the whole story before he starts. He knows the last line of the book before he begins. He knows the last line of each chapter before he starts the chapter. And he would say, and has said to me, Abraham, if you're making it up as you go along, Abraham, you're not a writer. You're an ordinary liar. You're just making it up as you go along. And yet I think there's something delightful for when you as a writer are following a voice and something surprising happens. I don't mean cheap surprise, but something that you feel must happen and yet it surprises you, it usually surprises the reader. So this time what I'm trying to do is really try to lay out the whole story as well as I can before I start, recognizing that there'll be many departures, but all I feel I'm doing is putting up a scaffold. I've got the bricks and the cement, and if the bricks don't work here, I'll move them over there. So I actually have put a big whiteboard in my living room, and it's now covered with figures and drawings. It defeats the purpose of a whiteboard because I can never erase it now. It seems, you know, something that I have to glaze over with protective paint or something. But I think I have the outline for a story. I even have a title, tentatively. It's called The Maraman Convention, which is a title that I hope will be slightly mysterious, like Cutting for Stone, until you read the book. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for being here. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Abraham Verghese speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. Verghese is a professor at the Stanford School of Medicine and the author of the novel Cutting for Stone, among other books. This was his talk from Portland Arts and Lectures in 2012. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.